Hi, everybody.
Hey,
my name is Franklin, and I am alcoholic. Breathe out, Franklin. Breathe in, God. Breathe out, Franklin. Breathe in, God. Breathe out, Franklin. Breathe in, God. I was born Francis Tyrone Magruder. My sobriety date, if I had to go back to it, is February 13th, 1993. However, I don't really know if that's my sobriety date because I had 2 years sober, and I've been coming to Napa for about 35 years, but I had 2 years sober, and I, all along, I was kind of thinking, especially after that first year, you know, I can just get all my stuff back, and I can just go back out, and nobody would ever know. 2 years into it, I did that. And I was standing back there behind the coffee pot, and the young ladies, you know, I was telling her, you know, that I had gone out, and I'll get to that part, but I need to speak to why that date, I don't know what the date it really is, maybe about 5 days, give or take, you know. But she says, you know, I wasn't going to pick up a chip, and she's like, well, you know, you don't pick up a chip for you, you pick up a chip to show people that this program works, you know. So that's why that day I picked up that chip was on the 13th of February. I was born the oldest of five. Two brothers, a brother and sister outside of my mother. I was the oldest. And the Francis part came about because my mother was a child. She was 15 when she had me. And her name was Mary Frances Magruder, God bless her, you know, and she wanted to name me Francis. Well, fifth grade and Francis don't quite go along. Okay, so somewhere down the line, and that whole thing about not feeling good enough, and my father's name is Franklin. My father's name is Franklin, you know, and I wanted to be Franklin. Francis just wasn't going to cut it, you know. And I think that's kind of probably where all of the things started, where I didn't feel like I was good enough, you know. And so somewhere or another, I changed my name, and I'm talking about to this day. My birth certificate to this day says Francis Tyrone Magruder. And I'm eligible for Social Security. That's just how crazy this is. But I have driver's license, Social Security card, passport. Everybody in the world knows me as Franklin. And the people that know me as Francis are at the DFAX office or they're no longer with us. So, I'm in the process now. And I didn't change it for a minute in years because my mother named me that name and I wanted to keep it because my mama named me Francis. But I wasn't cool with Francis, you know, but... you know, so that's kind of that whole part of not being good enough, you know. So, like I said, I was born the oldest of five. Didn't quite know my dad until I got older. But my grandparents, they made sure that they stayed in my life, you know. And I was raised by some good women. I was raised by women in my formative years, and I as I matured into, like, you know, elementary Boy Scouts and stuff like that. So then men start coming into my life, you know, to be more of on a mentor side, you know, which was good, you know, because growing up in a house with women that could beat you up ain't a good feeling. You know, and you can't really fight them because your family, you know, so you like get beat up, you know. I got beat up by women in elementary school because y'all could fight. We can't fight. But I walk through that whole period of being Francis, Ben Franklin, and transition to junior high, elementary school. I was a smart kid, but I didn't want to be smart. My friends were, now they call it special needs. My friends, my friends, they moved me out of that class, and I didn't want to be away from my friends, so I pretended like I didn't know how to do the work. You know, there's that whole part about not feeling good enough, you know. So that's that. Fast forward, going back to that, you know, that for me was a part that, have I regretted that? Yeah, because if you're smart, you're going to be smart. And I'll say this about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're sitting in here, you probably did some things that surprised yourself, like buying $1,000 worth of dope and didn't have no money. And I'm going to say this because drugs are part of my story, but I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we're very cunning, and we can make things happen, you know. And that's kind of been like the story of my life, you know. So elementary school, you know, I recall replacing, and I don't know when I started drinking, but I recall replacing food coloring in my grandmother's special liquor bottle. My grandmother used to have this bottle that she, with alcohol in it, that she'd have for people to come in, to come by the house, you know, and give them a drink, you know. And I recall drinking that and then replacing it with food coloring. Okay? Like, you can't know that that's been done, but you're a kid, you don't know, you know. So I came up with being the oldest, but still being an outsider with my family, because my two brothers had the same dad. My sister was separate, and then I was raised with a cousin who was my uncle's, her and I, we're really more sisters now. So I was kind of raised like that. But then my brothers start coming along, and they always kind of favored my little brother. You know, they always felt like, you know, his name was Troy, God bless him. He was murdered by a crackhead for $5. You know, and I had to take him off of life support and apologize to him, because the last time I had saw him, and I'm going to jump around, was at my grandmother's funeral. And I said to him, he was asking me for some money, you know. And I said, I'm sober. And I say to my brother, I don't give my money to junkies. I said that to my brother. He was dead 3 months later. Beat to death, $5 with an axe handle. My mother couldn't face it, so she sent me, he was brain dead, so she sent me to make the decision. This is in recovery, sober, you know, to take him off life support. And I gave him one of my chips. When we buried him, I put it in the coffin with him, you know. And his thing, you know. But my family had migrated to New York. And my mother was there, and my brothers and everybody was in New York. And as a kid, I never forget going to New York. I'm from Augusta, Georgia, you know. And when I saw New York City, oh, my God. I was like, wow, coming from the country, you know, New York City. But I couldn't, you know, I would go in the summers to visit my mother, you know, and she would keep the kids. She would keep my brothers, but I would go back home to my grandmother. Because, again, the relationship that her and I had was really almost like sister and brother, because remember, she's 15, so we kind of grew up together. And I was kind of, I didn't say resented it, but I wanted to be there with them, you know. And but I would always have to go back home, you know, to Augusta, you know. But I was always New York, you know. It changed me, and I'll get into how that has really kind of blown into my life today. Junior high school, I've made friends with people, you know. popular because I was able to go from kindergarten, junior high school in the same neighborhood. So, you know, in that situation, you know everybody. So it ain't like you meeting strangers. Everybody, you know, either know you or whatever. So, but you're all, it's probably, it shaped me, you know. But that being said, when I got in junior high school, I began to dream. I began to dream, and I wanted to. I've always been a voracious reader, and I like to read. And again, like I said, I was a smart kid, but I was pretending to be that I wasn't smart, you know. But I would always read, and I was reading all the great readers. I mean, whole books, you know, because I was trying to escape, you know. The house I grew up in, we owned it, so it wasn't a situation where we were like we was in the hood, but it wouldn't be considered the hood because it was the neighborhood, you know? I mean, you know what I mean, the hood. So that being said, I started wanting to move to New York with my mother, you know, in junior high school, and she, that couldn't happen, you know? So I, my drinking kind of was neighborhood stuff. We was drinking, so my drinking kind of increased. Wasn't really a lot of weed and stuff like that back then. I'm talking junior high school, you know. Then I did finally, but going to New York, I began to find out about other drugs, you know. And I experimented and tried all kind of stuff, you know. And I, at some point during that junior high school, I just was like, I want to be this great person. I don't know if anybody ever felt like that. I want to be this great person. But you didn't know how to get there because there was nobody in your family to show you that. So coming out of high school, I put myself, my grandmother didn't understand it, so I registered to go to college on my own, you know. I didn't make it through because my drinking had gotten really bad because I was hanging with people, you know, in school, you know, that I wasn't going to class. I wasn't really doing a lot, you know. And I was over here in Marsh Brown. I come to Atlanta. And that was during the time, and I'm going to date myself, that was during the time that Wayne Williams was killing kids, or when the Atlanta child murders were going on. And my folks was like, you are not going to stay there. And then I got to a fight, crazy fight. And I still held a scar on my eye because we were drunk when we were fighting a guy, and I should have known. But he came to fight a friend of mine, and we were trying to stick together. But I should have known this guy was a fighter because he had on fighter rings. You know, I mean, he had these rings on like he came to do something, you know. And you know, we were drunk, so he'd run up and he'd knock us out, you know. You know, actually knocked my, God bless him, he's no longer, he died of alcoholism. He got knocked out, you know, and like I said, my folks were like, well, you know, between the Dwayne Williams stuff and all that, it's like, you need to come back home. So I went back to Augusta. I was in Atlanta, went back to Augusta. Enrolled myself in Payne College of School at home, you know, and I, but I was still drinking. And I still didn't feel good enough. I mean, I used to drink Dress Androgynous. I don't know if you guys have seen Prince. You know, that was the time that we were growing up. Those were like our guys, you know. So we were just nothing to have the long Jerry curls and all of this. Now, it was androgynous. It was not that we was gay or no stuff like that, but we was wanted to be these people that we saw, you know, and on television. And that was a thing for me, wanting to be those people, you know, that I saw on television, you know. And then the music, and I loved music. I still collect music to this day. I was just telling my friend, I've got a cassette player in my truck, and I bought my truck because it had a cassette player in it, and I wanted that cassette player, you know. So somewhere in between me getting kind of not finishing school, but being able to get a good job at a major hospital in Augusta Medical College, you know, because I was always able to. I grew up working construction and different things like that because my family had that kind of, my grandmother's family had that kind of background. So I always worked, you know, and I always understood work, you know. So I understood how to finish, I learned how to pour cement, finish cement, how to lay blocks. And if anybody has ever done that, that does not make a man out of you. That's hard work. And I go back to a piece that I always go and hang out with my grandmother's people who were in South Georgia during the summers to hang out on the farm, you know. So I always kind of understood and knew what work looked like, you know. But somewhere along the line, I met the guy, and he had this, and like I said, drugs is a part of my story. You know, he had, I don't know, the '80s. We was in this room, like, because I was standing at my grandmother's house, but they had a room of my own in the back, you know. And he came in with this glass, you know, with this powder, and he was going to show us how to do this glass and this powder. As soon as I tried it, I was that person on TV. I was that person I always wanted to be. And as you go, as you know how we are, how I am, one is just not enough, you know. And more often, there's a shame, because, you know, they say alcoholism, we carry the shame. Here I was standing in my grandmother's house in my 20s, you know, and she's loving on me, you know, and I'm go out, spend all my money on Friday when I get paid, be gone, come back Monday, and my grandmother would still feed me and let me stay in her house, you know. And that went on for quite some time, and at some point it just stopped working for me. So I had to, like I said, I had this job at the Medical College of Georgia, and I got this idea. Scarface came out. And I'm going to take all my teacher's retirement from my job, and I'm going to go to Miami, and I'm going to be Scarface. And like I said, drugs is a part of my story, but I got sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. That back then was when that whole cocaine cowboy era was going on, and that's when I was down in Miami, and we were smoking off of cans because we didn't have the real apparatus, you know. And I'll say this, and I'm gonna get through it, but I did that, smoked off a can, and I passed out, threw up, passed out. Had never done that. Now you would think, I don't know how much money I went down there with, you know, but you would think that passing out on something and then coming to, I wouldn't go do that again, right? I woke up, I was looking for that can. God willing, I made it out of there, you know, made it out of Miami. Because at that time, we was catching train, like I said, I would be Tony Montana, but I didn't have no car, but I'm on the train. You know, and I got back up here, and, you know, that told don't get high, don't supply. I could never be that guy that made any money selling drugs because I was using all of it, you know. So that went on, like I said, you know, and now I'll get to the end of that part. My grandmother would always say, you know, like I said, she was still loving on me, even though I'm doing all of this stuff, spending all my money, not being able to support her, and she got the kids, still loving on me, you know. And somebody, you know, she's still praying for me. Now, my other grandmother, my father's mother, they were all praying for me. They were all putting up with my stuff, you know. And I you know, they're no longer here, but they, you know, they carried me. Because I should have been home. During that time, I should have been homeless or something, you know, because I just, no way, I could have got through that. So that being said, it stopped working at some point. And then I just shame, you know, to know and have to look at my grandma and them, you know, and what I was doing, I just shame. So, like I said, I was able to keep a good job. And I came to Atlanta. I was able to get a job at the VA because I had spent, I have some medical equipment, medical supply, and I had spent so much time in it, and I had, my resume looked good. So, you know, back then, they weren't laying people off. They was hiring people, you know. But I came up here with a job, and I, you know, but I knew all along that it just wasn't working for me. I didn't, you know, I grew up with the, this is your brain on drugs, you know, the commercial with the pot, you know. But I knew it wasn't working for me. I had to do something, you know. So, you know, how you change your geographic location. So I said, well, I'm going to go to Atlanta, you know, and got the job at the VA. That didn't last, you know, because I was still using. But during the time I started using, I found out, and I'm not going to say that the government is great enablers, but that's when I found out about going to treatment. And I would, because, you know, anybody that's prior military, they know about 100%, and they know how, and I ain't say they all game the system, but they know how to game the system. So it was like, look, man, you go, you know, you go, you know, you go to treatment, you spend all your money and go spend 2 weeks in rehab, you know, then come back, you know, you still got a check. You know, and I did that, you know. But at the end of treatment, something kind of stuck. Something kind of was like, I like this feeling, because it's always in my head. I wasn't born that person that had begun abusing alcohol and drugs. You know, I wasn't born that person. I was somebody that, I was that sick person that I had become. So something stuck during treatment, and, you know, so I started being able to get some time. But then, for some reason, I would always go back to using. And I never could understand, because I was terrified. I had been really just, drugs had really, I had seen, I came through the 70s of crack addiction. Luckily, be alive. As a matter of fact, all my friends are dead right now, you know. I'd go into prison, you know. And one day it says, only time I go get dope is when I drink, because that's when I got the courage. Because I was scared to go to the dope house on my own. But if I got some liquid courage, I would go. And somewhere or another, it kind of came together, like, maybe if you stop drinking, you won't go back and get no drugs, you know? And I kind of figured that out. So by that time, I got, so I was still staying with a woman, and I was staying over in the Bluff. I don't know if anybody know the Bluff. Simpson Road. My height of my addiction was over there. If anybody know Atlanta, that's Atlanta. I came out of the Bluff. They used to call me Easy over there, you know. But I met this woman, and I, like I said, I knew it wasn't working out. And I was, and then I started moving. I started staying with her, and we moved right over here to these apartments. You know, but she was still using, I was still using, you know. And somewhere during doing all of that, she got pregnant, you know, and I had a son, you know. And I, by that time, I had started having some, getting some time, you know. And I started over at the clubhouse on Claremont. Well, no, I started going to CA meetings, because I went to Charter Petrie. That's when it really stuck, when I went to Charter Petrie. Then I started going to the clubhouse over here. I forgot the name of this clubhouse on Claremont Road. Then I found Biscayne, right. Then I found Napa. And when I came to Napa, there was that. There was an old man in here. There's an old couch back there. And I still sit over there on that side of the room. Bro, you're sitting in my seat. But I still sit on that side of the room. Because when I came in here, I felt at peace. And I would go to video arcades just to get through them 24 hours, that time. I would, you do that. But there was no women at this clubhouse when I came here. When the flood came up here to look and do this, it was all just old, angry. They weren't angry. They was cool. We got sober together. But they was all shit talking, excuse my vernacular, talking old dudes. But they were all about sobriety. This is probably one of the best, and I've been clubhouses all over the world. But this Napa sobriety, it's hardcore and it's real. You know, it ain't just, a lot of those guys are not here, and I've become those guys, but those were the Joe Lewis's and people, and some people here do know the Joe Lewis's and those people of the world, you know, a lot of them wrapped around that building out there. But I started coming over here, and I started letting people get to know me, and I started doing the after meeting stuff, you know, meeting people, and started going through the steps. And they always say, you're not going to ever get sober, and this is, they said, the difference between N.A., and this is, I suspend judgment, but they said the difference between N.A. and A.A. is N.A. never does the fourth step. That's one of the things that the old timers used to say, you know. And I ended up doing the fourth step and started learning about the steps. And like I said, hanging with people that were serious about this, you know. And I started to get in time. Like I said, I ended up getting that 2 years. You know, and I started getting time, you know, and like I said, but coming out of my addiction, I was not employable. So I'm going to give you some of my experience, strength, and hope now. I was not employable, and I started passing out flyers for concerts and different things like that, because that's the only kind of job I could really have. You know, I was thin. I had, like I said, I was, you know, and this guy, I just saw him Saturday, turned me on to passing out flyers for, you know, Madea and all these big concerts that, I mean, plays and concerts and stuff, you know. And like I said, AA people are smart. We're smart. Never let nobody tell you you're not. We just make bad choices, you know. We're just sick, trying to get better. But I've managed, and I talk about my experience, strength, and hope. Every major entertainment event over the last 30 years, from Usher, Madea, Tyler, all the great acts that came out of Atlanta, Georgia, I was directly or indirectly involved in all of that. And I'm still involved in all of that to this day. You know, and nobody, they were on. And that kind of business, there's always parties and there's always kind of stuff going on. There was no Puffy Baby Oil stuff, you know, but that, you know, but we all did the crazy stuff, you know. But they would always look at me because they could not figure out. It was like, it was something about that guy. Because I wasn't drinking. Everybody would be drinking. I wasn't drinking. You know, I couldn't. So I'm afraid, you know. Now, like I said, during the course of all of this, and if y'all did the math on how much time I have, I started that business in 1993. Just as I was getting sober, and people was telling me, you are not going to be able to do this business, going to nightclubs, passing out flyers and doing stuff like that, passing out flyers all over Atlanta, you know, you couldn't be able to do that and stay sober. But it is the truth that if you want this program, you can do whatever you want to do. You can be in any kind of environment because you want this program, and that's kind of how it was for me, you know. But as I said, fast forward, people trust me. I've only just recently started breaking my anonymity, but people trust me. And I've been responsible for major entertainment events, major stuff, you know, all over the world, major, you know, and I'm sober. And this is all because of AA. And I'm so grateful for that because, like I said, all I could do is pass out flyers. And even now, to this day, I still pass out flyers because, to me, that humbles me because that was all I could do. I was cracking it. I couldn't do nothing else but go pass out flyers. And I was very good at it. I did it with pleasure, with, you know. And I created an advertising agency and became an advertising agency, a major advertising agency. From promotion, you know, if anybody knows the business, you know, so people trust me to make sure that, we call it getting their money back. They trust me to make what they have sexy enough where people will buy a ticket go watch this show or go do something like that. They trust me to do that, you know. And I'm so grateful, you know. So where I'm right now, the transition for me right now, you know, I've been in that business 30 years and it's just stopped working for me. But about 2 years ago, I was out in the Colorado. I love to travel. I've traveled all over the world so far, you know, and I love national parks. And I was out in Moab, Utah. I don't know if many people know where that is, but, you know, Arches National Park and all that stuff out there, you know. And I was out there, and I started having little health problems, you know, and, you know, but I was ignoring them, but I'm going to the doctor, you know. And I was out there, and it was late at night, and I was, you know, Moab is like 4 hours from Salt Lake City. Black dark. Ain't nothing out there. When the sun go down, if you don't know your way around, better go to your hotel room. But as the sun was setting, I was on the Colorado River, and I was taking a leak, and I pissed blood. Now, y'all, women, no, please don't take this kind of crazy. Y'all accustomed to that? We ain't accustomed to that. Okay. It was the longest night of my life. But when I got up, I knew I had to come back and I had to go get it checked out. And I checked out and come to find out that I had prostate cancer. But it wasn't bad enough where they wanted to do anything drastic, because I don't know much about that, but they can either take out your gonads or they could just put you on what they call active surveillance, you know. They put me on active surveillance, you know, and I'm like 2 years into that, you know. But that part of it, being sober and knowing that you, because you die, people die, men die, because we so ashamed, we don't tell nobody. Anybody, and I'm telling them, this for the men, if you are not going to check that, you're setting yourself up to die an ugly death. This is for men. We must take care of our health, you know. But I, you know, like I said, they check me out, you know, I go and, you know, I'm still kind of dealing with it. And for me, that's probably a turning point for me, you know, because that's when you're facing mortality like that, because I'm terrified because you hear all the bad stuff. And I didn't know I had it in my family until I was sitting on a death certificate of my granddad. And I was like, but because they don't talk about those kind of stuff. Like, yeah, but your breast cancer, they don't talk about that part. Y'all get it up here, we get it down there. You know, same thing, you know. But I've been dealing with that. You know, dealing with it, you know. Sober. I'm not drink. Now, I'm going to go back to something that, and then I'm going to fast forward and let you guys cut it off. My mother never recovered from my brother being killed. And she drank herself to death. And I couldn't reach her. I remember her saying she wanted to die, you know, and I had to watch my mother die an alcoholic death. And I had to be the one to make the decision to take her off of life support. So that's twice that I've had to do that in my sober life. And I did not drink, but it was the stand over your mom and know that there was nothing else could be done. And they put that on you. And my sister and them, they were just like, you know, I'm from the country. My sister and them were like, Mom, you know, she's still alive, you know, but she was brain dead. You know? So I dealt with that, you know, sober. So these past couple of years have been good, you know. I'm at the height of my career, about 2 or 3 years, but right after COVID, part of me when I came out of drinking, I started being in healthcare, and I worked at medical supply place and different places like that. And I became familiar with different kind of viruses and different things like that because I sold that as a part of what I was doing. When COVID hit, it freaked me out because I knew. Even if it wasn't real, I knew whatever they was talking about, that was real. Something was out here. Pestilence was out here. And I just didn't. I stopped coming to meetings. I got mad at people in Napa because they wouldn't wear masks. I mean, I was really tripping. And coming out of COVID, I decided I wanted to travel, and I started traveling. And I did. This is alcoholic. 10 countries in under 3 years. That's alcoholic. People don't do that. You know, especially if you can't afford it. I just did it. I was like, I want to go. You know, so I did that, you know, and I got that out of my system. Seen some great things. You know, I collect art. All the things that I dreamt to do when I was growing up that I was feeling like I couldn't really do, I just started doing this in recovery. So that being said, I have been able to live a very good life and live all the things that I wanted to do, that I dreamt to do in recovery, sober. And it's available to anyone. You know, don't do it like me now. Don't do it when you got the money to do it. You know. But I'm going to wrap it up. How it is for me today, I have a great life. I deal with my health stuff. My son, I don't see him. I told him to come. I raised him. During the course of from third grade, and I'll go to this real quick, third grade to 12th grade, after I got divorced, I was a single parent, so I raised a boy, a man. He's 33 now, 34 now. And I did all of that sober, you know, and he reminded me that I was bringing him to AA meetings, you know, because I would bring him over here with me, you know. So I've been a single parent, done that. Last year, I came off a big travel binge, and I don't know what was going on with me, but I started slipping, and I just recommitted myself to AA heavily, you know, because I know I'm still got the isms. Let me tell you how much I got the isms. I even thought not to even, my man trusted me to come over here, and I would still do this thing where I would go and say, I'm not going to go do that. Why are you going to do that? The man trusts me, you know. So I came over here, but I'll tell you how it is for me today. It's a great life. I'm not drinking. I've been fortunate enough to do all the things that I dreamt of doing as a kid, that I drank the illusion to be able to do. I made that realized in recovery. I've met some great people. If I don't ever have to take another picture with another celebrity, that's too soon for me. Right now, I collect memories over material things. So I would say to anyone, if you're in here, and I don't know what kind of time you got, if you give this program a chance, everything that you've aspired to do, or where you felt not good enough to do, that you wanted to do, and you just couldn't see how you can do it. By me not drinking, I was able to figure that part out, like when they talk about in the promises. You know, those promises came true for me because I began to realize how to make all that work. So, if I had to say anything, I lived the promises today, and my life today, AA is the center of my universe. You know, whatever I'm doing, I know where a meeting is anywhere I am because I always check in. And I would say to anyone, you know, if you do that, you got a shot at this. But I'll leave you with something that they said to me in treatment. They said, look around you. See the people that you see sitting here with you? And that number hadn't changed. 75% of them ain't going to be here. Because this program is for those that want it, not for those that need it. So, like the reservations I had, if you got any reservations about you can do this successfully, go try some control, whatever you do. And we're going to still be here when you get back. Thank you.
I slipped and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see takes me where the promise is. All is. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants drive, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Take me where the